from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Thousands of elderly Granite Staters live in long-term care facilities that have been taking precautions to keep this vulnerable population safe from COVID-19, including restricting visits from family members and canceling group activities. But the illness has now shown up in alarming numbers in some New Hampshire nursing homes, as reported by state officials just yesterday, with cases increasing substantially in about a week. Both residents and staff have tested positive, and there have been several deaths. More cases are expected. This hour on The Exchange, we look at what can be done to better protect residents and workers in these settings. Meanwhile, many more New Hampshire elderly live in their own homes, and family caretakers are also trying to protect their loved ones, abiding by such guidelines as social distancing while trying to maintain a feeling of connectedness. And so this hour, we'll also discuss the challenges of caring for the elderly in various settings during these precarious times. To begin, we turn to NHPR's Casey McDermott. She's been covering the outbreaks of COVID-19 at nursing homes. She joins us by Skype. Casey, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
So, Casey, state officials announced just yesterday, as I said, they'd identified nearly 100 cases among residents and staff at three facilities, Hanover Hill in Manchester, Huntington in Nashua, and Crotchet Mountain in Greenfield. Officials also confirmed there have been 10 deaths related to COVID-19 at these facilities. What did the state say, Casey, about this whole situation?
Sure. So we started hearing about this a little over a week ago at two of those facilities, Hanover Hill and Crotchet Mountain. And we reported on the situation at those facilities at that time based on information that we were able to confirm. Now, we did not know until yesterday the scale of the outbreaks at those facilities. All we knew is that they were dealing with them. We did have some numbers relative to the situation at Crotchet Mountain, but not at Hanover Hill and not at the Huntington in Nashua. What we learned yesterday was that essentially the state said that the situation had gotten severe enough at each of the facilities that they felt it warranted further disclosure and further explanation. Now, the state said that at Hanover Hill, for example, they characterized the outbreak as being contained to one floor. At the Huntington, they said that it was contained to just the assisted living facility on that campus. Now, it bears noting, though, at, you know, for example, facilities like Hanover Hill, I can't speak to what's going on at this particular moment inside the facility, but my understanding is that given kind of staffing concern, or, you know, staffing shortages or just challenges there that are faced by many such facilities, that there is traditionally a fair amount of movement among staff between various parts of a facility like that. So when we say that an outbreak is contained to a particular portion of the facility, that may not necessarily mean that, you know, the virus was contained to only that location.
Well, and as we've learned, unfortunately, this virus is very difficult to contain. It spreads very easily. How does this story, Casey, what we learned yesterday, fit into the broader pattern of COVID-19 across New Hampshire?
Yeah, I think that was what was most stark about the numbers that we received yesterday. As you said, there were nearly 100 cases that have been identified among both residents and staff of these facilities. I ran that against the total number of positive cases that have been identified or confirmed by the state so far, and that makes up about 12%, which is a fairly sizable chunk when you think about it. And then additionally, the fatalities that have been linked to COVID-19 at these facilities thus far, there have been 10. That's out of 18 total deaths confirmed to be attributed to COVID-19 in New Hampshire thus far. That's more than half of all of the fatalities related to COVID. So there are a lot of reasons why this virus can be, you know, more challenging, particularly in facilities like this, where you're dealing with people who already have a number of health challenges, you know, whether you're dealing with older adults, whether you're dealing with other people who have very delicate medical situations, and also where you're dealing with staff who are tasked with, you know, a really challenging responsibility of caring for those people who have such significant medical needs. This can be really a particular challenge, as we've seen here in New Hampshire and also as we've seen in other states.
Just by their very nature, the populations at these facilities, you seem to be saying, Casey, are especially vulnerable. So when we look at these death rates, you know, that helps explain it.
It does. It does. And additionally, I mean, I'm sure that you'll get into this discussion later on in the show, but just the setup at some facilities, you know, sometimes you have people sharing rooms. Sometimes you have, you know, to encourage in under normal circumstances, people being able to socialize and you know, avoid isolation at these facilities. There's communal dining, there's activities, there's a lot of, you know, kind of socializing under normal circumstances. Now, in many cases, those activities have ceased for the last month or so, given COVID-19. And there was a federal directive that actually shut down visitation, except under, you know, very, very limited circumstances at facilities like this. So there are steps in place and steps being taken to try to prevent the spread, to try to contain it. But again, for the reasons that we mentioned, it can be a challenge. Additionally, one of the things that's also important to note is that facilities of this nature are experiencing a significant kind of staffing crunch right now. You know, it's been a challenge to recruit people to fill positions. There have been concerns about a lack of adequate protective equipment at facilities, you know, like the ones that we mentioned across the state. And I know the state is working on that, but that's also a concern that we've heard that has made it difficult to fully address the situation.
Well, and as you mentioned, later in the hour, we have three guests who are all working on this issue. We've got somebody from the state, someone who oversees facilities like this. So we'll definitely get into that with them. A couple more questions, though, Casey, about your reporting. So until yesterday, the state did not release the names of these institutions, just gave overall statewide and community-wide numbers. What reason was given, Casey, for the change in disclosure, naming names?
Sure. What we heard yesterday from state officials was essentially that the situation had escalated in recent days to the point where they felt like disclosure was warranted. Now, we had been asking for more details and asking about the state's decision not to disclose facilities where they had identified cases of COVID-19 for the last week. And what we were told was that the state, you know, interprets federal privacy provisions to prohibit them from doing that. Now, and in contrast, however, to some other states, including Vermont and Massachusetts, that have taken the step of disclosing the existence of COVID-19 at health facilities like the ones that we've been talking about. So it really is kind of a state by state. There are differences in state-by-state application and state-by-state interpretation of federal health privacy rules. But what we were hearing from, you know, family members who have loved ones who either work or live at Hanover Hill in particular, was that they were really concerned that the lack of disclosure up until yesterday put the public and put other people who may have connections to the facilities at a disadvantage for really being able to evaluate the situation, to take steps to protect themselves, to take steps to advocate for their family members or their loved ones, and that, you know, really they wanted to see more transparency from the state and from the facilities. And what the state was saying as well, I should note, is that they were leaving it up to individual facilities to decide how best to disclose the situation. And, you know, while we did obtain the messages that were being sent out from Hanover Hill specifically to family members over the last week or so, family members who may have loved ones at the facility, those messages, at least the ones that we saw, did not indicate the scale of the outbreak. So we did not know until yesterday that at Hanover Hill, this was affecting nearly 50 people. All we knew was that it was affecting people at the facility. So I think that's also another important point, is that, you know, state officials who ostensibly have a role in overseeing these facilities, licensing these facilities, you know, were the ones who came in and really let the public know about how severe it was there.
So you had found out about Hanover Hill. You reported on it, gosh, I think it was about a week ago, although, as you just said, you didn't recognize the scale of it. How did you learn about Hanover Hill? Did family members contact you? Or
Exactly. So and that's actually something that I would really encourage people to continue to reach out to NHPR. We have a survey on our website, nhpr.org, where we're asking people to share their experiences, their concerns about COVID-19 in general. But, in particular, as we mentioned, the only reason that we were able to report on these situations and the only reason that we frankly knew about them last week was because people who had connections to these facilities spoke up and shared what they knew with us. And then we took the appropriate steps to verify that information before reporting it. But in the absence of wider disclosures from the state or from the facilities, that was all that we had. So it's really, really important as well for us to hear from people who have personal connections and can speak to the real human side of this. As you mentioned, this is a really difficult time for people who have loved ones in these facilities, people who are living in these facilities. There's a lot of fear, there's a lot of anxiety. And I think that there's a real hunger for more conversation around how this is being managed, particularly for some of the state's most medically vulnerable residents. So, NHPR, definitely we have an interest in continuing to report on this important issue. So we would welcome people to share their thoughts with us and to continue to do that moving forward.
So have you heard of any state lawmakers, Casey, taking this issue on, pushing for more information to be made public?
No, not yet. That doesn't mean that it's not happening, but I've not heard anything like that specifically at this time. Most of what I've heard in the last week has been from, again, family members and from people who have connections to these nursing homes and these long-term care facilities who felt that they wanted to see more transparency around COVID-19 and how it was being handled.
What questions do you still have, Casey, about how the state is approaching the management of COVID-19 at facilities like the ones named yesterday?
Well, so another thing that's worth mentioning is that the state did acknowledge yesterday that they're aware of COVID-19 at about 10 other facilities statewide. So I'm curious about the scale and the severity of the situation at those facilities. Like we said, the state opted to disclose the information about Hanover Hill, the Huntington, and Crotchet Mountain because they felt that it was severe enough to warrant that disclosure. But I'm curious about the criteria that they're using to evaluate when disclosure is necessary. I'm also curious about the level of support and when the state started stepping up its support for these facilities. Hanover Hill, for example, posted over the weekend on its Facebook page a picture and an expression of gratitude for the state for dropping off some additional deliveries of personal protective equipment. What we heard from state officials yesterday was that they've been working with these facilities. It's been very collaborative. They seemed to indicate that there was not an issue with personal protective equipment shortages. I can say that, looking at even just the social media posts that we've seen from Hanover Hill in the last week, that post about the state's delivery of protective equipment over the weekend said that they were really grateful, but they needed more. So that seems to indicate, as well as what we're hearing from people who have loved ones in the facility, that there is still a challenge in getting the right equipment to, the frontline healthcare workers and others who are still doing the really difficult but really important work of caring for people in these facilities.
Well, and we will definitely talk about that with our guests this hour. Casey, we'll let you go. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
That's NHPR's Casey McDermott. And Exchange listeners, as we talk about caring for the elderly in this pandemic, we do want to hear from you. If you're an older Granite Stater, what are your concerns about the coronavirus, the related shutdowns and restrictions? Tell us how you're managing. And if you're taking care of an elderly family member, what do you want to ask or share? Send us an email. That's exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Todd Fahey, State Director of AARP New Hampshire, Also, Melissa St. Cyr, Chief Legal Officer at the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. She also worked for many years as a nursing home administrator. And Brendan Williams, President and CEO of the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, which represents long-term care providers, including nursing homes and assisted living facilities. And Melissa, I'd like to open with you first, please. How does the state plan to approach this situation from here on out with these nursing homes that Casey mentioned, where COVID-19 appears to be spreading rapidly?
Sure. Thank you. So the state has been very involved in the, you know, obviously these three outbreaks, as well as any positive tested COVID out in the community or in other nursing facilities. So we have, you know, our public health department tracks all of these individuals, does investigations in all these individuals that have tested positive to see how they may have contracted the illness, who they may have been in contact with while they've been symptomatic. And they continue to work with each of these facilities, whether it's through, whether it is, you know, on a larger scale like it is at Hanover Hill and Huntington, or if it's just one individual in a nursing facility. They work very closely with those individuals to contain, to investigate, and to provide as much support as they can so the situation doesn't worsen in these long-term care facilities.
Well, and given the increase, are there additional steps, Melissa, that the state will take now when it comes to checking in on these facilities and others where cases have cropped up, not just these three?
So I think, you know, I don't want to say that they're taking additional steps, because from the very beginning they have been very involved, and so have their local public health networks as well. Hanover Hill has Manchester and Nashua. The public health folks in Nashua have also been very helpful. Public health has been involved in these from the very beginning. And I know there's a lot of talk about personal protective equipment and staffing and all of those concerns. And those are things that public health has been involved with from the very beginning to assist as much as we can in assisting these facilities in containing the amount of people that get sick. So I wouldn't necessarily say that we're doing more now than we were before, but long-term care has been something that we've been concerned with from the very beginning. You know, the elderly have been known to be more susceptible to this illness, and those especially that have comorbidities or other you know, things that may be medically wrong with them. So we have been attempting to, you know, work very closely with all of the long-term care and all of the elderly, you know, even our home and community-based services, those who are elderly out in the communities, to, you know, educate and hopefully give them the tools for them to be successful in containing this illness.
Well, and Casey told us that, again, yesterday officials named the three facilities where cases have escalated, but they also revealed that at least 10 other residential facilities have seen cases, though none at the scale of the three named yesterday. At what point, Melissa, does the state begin naming names? At what point is this public information?
So I don't necessarily think that there's a exact point. Certainly, you know, when tracking, when looking at the illness and how it's progressing through a facility such as this, you know, it's up to the epidemiologists and those that are really knowledgeable at the state about disease progression and communicable disease to make a decision on when they believe, you know, it's become an outbreak, something that is that warrants further disclosure to protect the public health. And so, you know, those are taken on a case-by-case basis. These three obviously were considered through their analysis to require that additional disclosure. And so I think that we'll just continue to track as a department. We'll continue to track the facilities that currently have any exposure to COVID, and hopefully you know, hopefully they'll be contained enough that we won't have to disclose anymore, but, you know, we'll certainly take that on a case by case basis.
That's interesting. So there's not a number at which, Melissa, the state says, ooh, this is getting too dangerous, we need to report now. I mean, from the perspective of a family member, like, one case is worth reporting because we know this virus spreads so easily and so quickly. But there's no point at which the state says, okay, now we're going public.
No, I think it depends, because every facility is situated very differently. You know, they're all set up very differently. Some have private rooms and a lot of space. Some are semi-private rooms and more contained. Some are, much smaller. And so an outbreak at a small facility that may only have 10 residents, an outbreak could be 3 or 4, where, a much larger facility, an outbreak would be larger. So it's hard to say that there is a hard and fast, decision on every, that at this point, when it gets to this point, we disclose. I think it's just up to our team and the epidemiologists and the communicable disease team to make that decision. And I'm sure Brendan can talk more about that as well.
Sure. Yeah, Brendan, and this is probably surprising for many listeners who aren't involved in this issue, like the three of you, that there aren't reporting requirements for nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and so forth in the state. So what requirements are there, Brendan, if any?
Well, I think each facility is reporting to certainly its residents, to its staff, and also to family member contacts when there are instances of infection. To date, we've just seen the three facilities that were identified yesterday that I'm aware of. And I know that those notices have gone out. We've been deferring to the state epidemiologists who have been excellent. We had a Zoom webinar with them this week. We've been having one each week, and they share with the facilities the latest guidance and take a lot of questions. And I can assure you that those questions go on and on from facilities, and the guidance itself keeps changing. For example, not just from the CDC, but nursing homes are regulated by the federal government. So we get a lot of new guidance from the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And the latest guidance requires all facility personnel to wear a face mask, for example, while they're in the facility. Every resident has to be checked for symptoms and have their temperatures checked every day. Patients and residents who enter facilities are supposed to be screened for COVID-19 through testing if available, but it's not. And then staff, as much as possible, are not to work across units or floors. So, we've got a lot of protocols in place. I think one of the things that Commissioner Chibonet had said yesterday is that, facilities have been accustomed to infection control protocols, whether it be the norovirus or the flu. This is obviously something very different, in as much as people can be asymptomatic. And so a temperature check might not reveal that they're infected, but infection control is something that nursing homes are used to.
Wow, and I do appreciate that the guidance keeps changing as people learn more about this disease, and that, the CDC and the Centers for Medicaid, Medicare Services, that all that advice keeps changing. I'm just trying to get a sense, Brendan, then, what the requirements are, and it sounds like it's up to the state health officials as to whether a facility has to report or not. There's no sort of hard and fast rule. That's the sense that I'm getting from you, Melissa.
There is not a hard and fast. There isn't a hard and fast rule as to when we alert the public of an outbreak, but there is a requirement that facilities report a positive COVID test to the public health department.
Right.
So there is requirements, and they do follow through on those requirements, and all of our facilities have been in compliance with that. So they are reporting to public health. It's just when public health is obviously bound by confidentiality as well as these facilities. So public health then, does their investigation and looks at the disease process, and then makes a determination as to when that information will go out to the public.
So, Brendan, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but when there is a positive COVID case at a particular facility, families do need to be notified at a bare minimum. Is that correct, Brendan?
Yes, and they are notified. Each resident will have family member contacts, and so those family member contacts are notified. In some cases, I've talked to the family members myself because they've called me having seen my name in news articles. And so they have been notified. I think last week, the governor had suggested that administrators of facilities could share the fact that the virus was present in those facilities. And so two of the facilities that we represent, the Huntington at Nashua and Hanover Hill, had put out press releases to disclose that the virus was present in the facilities. And now the state's taken a step further by revealing the exact totals in those facilities, and we're fine with that. That's easier for the state to disclose in some ways than facilities which are concerned about a 21-point patient's bill of rights here in New Hampshire.
All right. Well, Todd Fay, I haven't forgotten about you. And after a short break, I do want to follow up on some of the things that you mentioned, Brendan. You know, testing, whether your staff has the protective gear that it needs. And we'll start taking phone calls and emails from listeners as well. Again, we really encourage you to call in as we talk about caring for New Hampshire's elders. This is the group, as we all know, that is seen as most vulnerable to the coronavirus. We'll find out how to best protect older Granite Staters and how to ease some of the social and emotional isolation that comes with this. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, caring for New Hampshire's elders, the group most vulnerable to the coronavirus and COVID-19. We are asking our guests how they think we can best protect older Granite Staters and how to ease some of the isolation that has come with restrictions and so forth. And we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. With us for the hour, Melissa St. Cyr, Chief Legal Officer at the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services and a former nursing home administrator, Brendan Williams, President and CEO of the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, which represents care facilities, including nursing homes and assisted living facilities. Also with us, Todd Fahey, State Director of AARP New Hampshire. And all of you, let's go to our listeners. Ryan is waiting in Portsmouth. Ryan, thank you for calling in.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm fine, Ryan. Go ahead. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. My mom is a worker, actually, at Hanover Hill Nursing Home, and my grandmother is a patient there. So I've been directly affected by the large amount of presence of the virus at that facility. It's been pretty hard. My mother's been sick for about 10 days now, and for a long time she wasn't getting better. It wasn't just a mild case. My grandmother had a high temperature there. We found out recently that it was negative, but it was a lot of worry. She's 85, and we weren't sure if it was going to go one way or the other with her. So I've had a lot of concerns about the facility there.
Wow, Ryan, so your mom is a nurse at the facility? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's correct.
Wow. And how's she doing now?
She was actually starting to feel better yesterday. But it was, you know, that I think that was maybe like day 11 that she had had it, that she was just starting to feel better. Wow. When she first got sick, I was kind of assuming, okay, well, this is going to be just a mild thing. She's not too old. But it wasn't like that. It was bad. And it was actually my birthday on Sunday. And I was kind of just thinking like, is my mom going to die? You know,
because it was that bad,
she was having a lot of pain.
How old is your mom, if I might ask?
I believe that she's, I'm going to get real close. I believe 54.
Okay, so she's in her mid-50s, your grandma's in her mid-80s, and you've really gotten a double whammy, Ryan, with this.
Yeah, definitely. It was very worrisome, I think, because I had kind of had a little bit of a notice that it was at Hanover Hill because my mom works there and she was diagnosed a little bit, you know, a week or more ago than we just got the notice yesterday about how bad it is there. But I was really surprised that my grandmother had gotten it.
Well, Ryan, just please let me express my best wishes to you and hopes to your family. You've really been struggling with this, and I really hope everyone gets well soon. And I did want to ask all our guests about some of the things that you raise. And to you at first, Todd Fahey, just Ryan's expressing, you know, just the anxiety and fear that everybody has. And then he's had to deal with it, not just in terms of the abstract, it might happen, but it did happen. What do you think, Todd?
Well, good morning, Laura. So what we think is, this really expresses and underscores how vicious and just brutal this disease is, and how it affects certainly the older residents, particularly those people in various care settings. So, from we're talking about people in facilities now, and we understand from the news what that looks like and how rapidly this spreads. But it also really talks about the whole spectrum. It's those people who are giving care, whether they be nurses or home health aides or family caregivers. And it really underscores how serious we need to take this in the various care settings that people find themselves in New Hampshire, because, you know, by many numbers, we're the second oldest state in the nation. So we do have an aging population, particularly susceptible to this this virus and this pandemic, and it really makes the point of how serious we need to take it. One thing we would say, too, is that knowledge is power, and I think that really is something we're seeing over and over again, insofar as we're being told to follow advice from the CDC and local health authorities and abiding by the governor's orders. But knowledge is power. So in many cases, in situations such as this, we would suggest to our folks that they ask questions of the facilities, because there's a finite number of people connected to any facility, really. I mean, except for the exponential spread of the virus, obviously. But in the first instance, people can ask questions, and we suggest that they ask certain questions of the facilities so they can educate themselves, whether their loved ones will be prospective residents in the facility, or whether they're already in the facility.
What kinds of questions do you think that older people and also, their adult children should ask?
Well, we have just six of them. I mean, here's the first one. Has anyone in the nursing home tested positive for COVID-19? What's the nursing home doing to prevent infections? Does the nursing home staff have the PPE, the personal protective equipment, like masks, face shield, gowns, gloves, that they need to stay safe and to keep their patients safe? What is the nursing home doing to help residents stay connected with their families or other loved ones? Because, as you know, there's this order that there's no visitation except for extreme circumstances. And so connectedness is really important. What's the plan for nursing homes to communicate important information to both residents and families? And is the nursing home currently at full staffing levels for nurses, aides, and other workers? None of that is to say that we don't fully understand the severity of this global pandemic. I mean, few of us, if any, can underestimate what we're living. But asking those questions will at least equip people to begin figuring out what their responses to the situation are, given the answers that they receive.
And Brendan, I've talked to so many healthcare workers in the past couple weeks, and this continuing issue of lack of personal protective equipment, it just seems to keep coming up again and again. What's the status right now, Brendan, at the facilities that your organization represents in terms of having enough?
Well, I think it's pretty dire. I can just tell you with respect to Hanover Hill, for example, that I personally delivered a box of N95 respirators to that facility donated by the Grafton County Nursing Home 2 days ago. 3 days ago, a box of N95 respirators donated by Pleasant View Care Center in Concord. So we really do have, consistent with those questions that Todd's asking, a shortage right now of personal protective equipment, particularly in light of the latest CMS guidance that all personnel be masked while they're in the facilities. I was quoted in the New York Times over the weekend just sort of describing this Darwinian free-for-all that exists with respect to procuring personal protective equipment. There's a lot of charlatans and price gougers out there advertising their services. We as an association have ordered 2,000 face shields, 2,000 surgical masks, 2,000 disposable hospital gowns, just to be able to respond to any long-term care provider, whether it be at home or in a facility in need, and that doesn't feel like enough.
Wow.
So it's Melissa, a real challenging situation.
I love your thoughts, too, on this, Melissa, and any information that you might have about efforts to procure more of this personal protective equipment for long-term care facilities.
Sure, yeah. So we have an emergency services unit who is right now spending, there's multiple people spending every minute of every day, attempting to procure personal protective equipment for all of the healthcare workers and all of the healthcare system. Obviously, those who have significant concerns and issues related to it are prioritized. But on a daily, hourly basis, you know, we're working very, very diligently to get as much personal protective equipment into the state of New Hampshire as possible. And we have our 211 system, which is if any of these healthcare facilities are in need of personal protective equipment, to contact 211, and then we will get them on the list of those that need that, and we will attempt to procure and provide as much personal protective equipment as we possibly can to those facilities.
Where's it coming from, Melissa? You know, we just heard that it's sort of coming from all sorts of sources. Where is the state getting the bulk of its materials from? Maybe it's 24 sources. I don't know.
It's more than 24 sources. We're attempting to track down every lead, and Brendan is correct. You know, there's been a lot of people, unfortunately, who have attempted to, you know, have some sort of gain from this crisis. And so we are spending a lot of time investigating, you know, and ensuring that we have appropriate businesses that we're engaging. And we're tracking down every lead in every possible way that we can procure some PPE. We're doing it.
Wow. Well, and toward that end, we have an email here from Kellyanne who says, just as it is important to focus resources on protecting residents and staff at nursing homes and residential facilities, Kellyanne says it is important to support home care workers, particularly the non-medical support workers who are assisting thousands of older adults and families who live in community. Kellyanne says they desperately need access to PPE. And I'm so glad you wrote in, Kellyanne, because Todd, I did want to ask you about this. You know, we focus a lot on the facilities, and understandably so, but just remind us, Todd, a lot of Granite State elders live at home.
Sure. I mean, the great preference of people who are able to live at home and do so safely is that they live at home in their communities. That's where they want to be. More than 85-90% of those we've surveyed over and over again indicate that they wish to remain in their home in communities if they can. Oftentimes, they are cared for in the first instance by family caregivers, those people who are not paid and they're not professionals. And we count amongst their numbers about 177,000 of those people who need to help many of our older residents and loved ones stay in their homes consistent with their wishes. Then there's another group of people who are assisted, thankfully, by the home health care workers who do incredible work on a daily basis. But it's really worth remembering that they help these folks with the most, in many cases, the most intimate of activities of daily living. I mean, so one can't practice social distancing trying to help somebody get cleaned or dressed or showered or bathed. And so that point is a good one, that it's really, really critically important that we think about that whole subset of people, because there's a limited number of people in our facilities statewide. And there are thousands of others who live at home, and then there are thousands who live at home, and they do so with the assistance of these fine people who go out every day and provide these in-home services.
Wow. In a pretty anxiety-producing environment, Todd, right? I mean, I'm wondering if your average home health worker who has, you know, 6 or 7 people that she sees during the week, and it usually is a she who doesn't make a lot of money, I mean, what kind of support do these people have?
Well, I mean, you know, again, everybody needs to, it's a situation where we're dealing with something we've never really encountered before as a world and as a nation and as a state. So we're trying to figure this out. And as Brendan and I think Melissa also said, I mean, some of the guidance is changing daily. So I think people are trying to educate themselves and to stay safe because, you know, we need to remember it's not only the people who are providing care, it's the people who are most vulnerable who are getting the care. But the vicious virus doesn't discriminate. It affects all people equally badly. I mean, obviously the outcomes tend to fall disproportionately on the elderly and those with underlying conditions. But nonetheless, you know, all people have reason to fear what this potentially can do if they contract it.
Sure, just like Ryan's mom, who was, you know, 54, 55 years old. So coming up, I definitely want to go back to our listeners. We've got lots of calls and emails lined up. But I also want to ask all of you about testing, how expanded testing might make your jobs easier, and we should definitely discuss the social, emotional isolation that many Granite State elders are facing in this crisis. So all that's coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're asking how to care for older Granite Staters, given that they're most vulnerable to the coronavirus. Also, how to ease the isolation that comes with social restrictions. Let's hear your questions and your stories. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. I'm talking this hour with Todd Fahey, State Director of AARP New Hampshire, also Melissa St. Cyr, Chief Legal Officer at the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services, and a former nursing home administrator, along with Brendan Williams, President and CEO of the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, which represents long-term care providers. And all of you, let's go right back to our listeners. Donna's calling in from Brentwood. Hi, Donna. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, good morning. I'm actually a nurse practitioner in one of our county homes here in Brentwood, and we've been lucky enough not to have any staff or patients test positive. We've done multiple things to help ensure we reduce as much risk to both residents and staff, some of which the guests have already talked about. So I just wanted to share some of that, if that's something that you think.
Yeah, go ahead, Donna. That's really interesting.
So we started this probably about a month ago, and obviously we do follow the state and CDC guidelines. We have multiple calls every week with various state agencies. We screen all of our staff coming in based on an algorithm, which includes fever, sore throat, loss of taste, multiple things. And if a patient or if a staff member actually flags for one of those things, then the screeners, who are registered nurses, either call myself or our occupational health nurse, who are both here on site. From there, we make the determination based on symptoms, based on remote contacts. Is it somebody who we can safely keep here and work, or should we send them home? Or do we refer to their PCP for some sort of testing? So we've had all of those screening places in place for about a month. We have had staff up until about a week ago wear masks should they choose to wear masks. Obviously, in a patient who's on isolation, meaning we're actively testing them for COVID or they've tested positive for COVID, wear full PPE as outlined by the guidelines. About a week ago, we mandated that all staff, regardless of where they work in the food services, environmental services, anyone who enters the building has to wear a mask. So those are either cloth masks or surgical masks. And then in the event they do go into a suspected patient's room or a questionable room, then they again do the full PPE. So we
and you've got what you need, Donna. Do you have enough of those masks and other elements of PPE?
You know, we actually do. So for something like this, we weren't prepared for this. However, we always prepare for this. So we've always had a pseudo stockpile, and I did love the guest, and I'm not sure which one talked about the Darwinian response, and that's so true. We actually had a gift of 595 from a company. So some of the masks we received were masks that would not fit any of our staff, and we subsequently donated them to another organization. When our staff got wind of that, there was a lot of disgruntled staff not understanding the rationale why we were passing on those masks. So the Darwinian response, I think, is so true, not only from the general public, but within the healthcare provider world as well.
Well, people are stressed out and fearful. If I could ask you one last question, Don, and I'm really glad you called. It's really interesting to hear from you. You talked about screening staff coming in, you know, based on those algorithms you mentioned, you know, fever, loss of taste, and so forth. Wouldn't you rather have just, you know, testing, Donna, given that we know now that people can be completely asymptomatic? They can feel fine. They can have no fever. You know, they can be whistling a tune and they are still carrying this virus. So wouldn't you rather just have a test?
That's a really tricky question, and I'll tell you why. Because there is some level of false positives, and then the person that tests negative today doesn't necessarily mean they'll test negative tomorrow.
Well, exactly. They could go out in the public and get it somewhere. Yeah.
Correct. And we do have, we still have a lag in getting test results back. We don't have the rapid test readily available to us. We have some people where it's still taking 4, 5, 6, and even 7 days to get tests back. So with that said, if we were to test everybody on an ongoing basis, we wouldn't have any staff here to work because we'd be waiting for all of those tests. Because
I've heard that there are rapid result tests, or maybe that's not widely available, though.
Well, it's definitely not widely and readily available.
Sure.
In addition, I don't know if anybody follows local news. They had some news programs on last night. And in New York, for example, they sent them, it's an Abbott quick response test, but they didn't send them test strips to use.
Yeah, we've heard about that.
So very similar here.
Kate, Donna, I'm going to let you go because I got a couple other callers on the line, but I really appreciate you sharing your experiences. And I want to go just quickly to my guests, and I think to you, Brendan. So she's got the PPE that she needs, but it's tricky testing, screening. What are your thoughts around that, Brendan?
I think optimally we would have more testing because then you could surveil the virus as it spreads throughout the community. I think Massachusetts has, you know, been pretty successful in conducting a lot of tests. I know that the National Guard is going facility by facility there and doing testing, which is why you now have over 100 facilities identified as having the virus in them in Massachusetts. The governor yesterday expressed his extreme consternation over the fact that we don't have the rapid result tests here from the federal government that we were promised. And I think our congressional delegation has very pointedly, Senator Shaheen has related concerns to the federal government over our lack of access to those tests. It is troubling for me when I see the guidance from the federal government that, residents who enter facilities should be screened for COVID-19 through testing if available. Well, it's not available. So we really can't, follow that particular guidance. Instead, we resort to the types of screening protocols that the caller was referring to, which are good, but they're not fail safe.
Sure. And I was in no means trying to criticize her. It's just she's doing the best she can with what she has.
No, she is. She is. Absolutely. And I think to Ryan's point, we're sort of seeing the bills, and this is true in the home care setting, too, for just our longstanding societal neglect of long-term care. I mean, they're coming due now. We've got a workforce on its front line in nursing homes that's 92% women. Those are the licensed nursing assistants. Home care aides, 89% women, and we as a society have marginalized these essential workers and those they care for.
And undervalued them with low pay, right, Brendan?
Well, yeah, we're the only New England state right now that isn't rushing to the assistance of long-term care by spending the extra federal Medicaid assistance that was made available to states.
All right. Well, lots of listeners who want to jump in. Such an important topic. Here's an email from Anne, who says, my father lives in a memory care unit in Dover. I have been visiting him through the window. The window is always closed, Anne says. While I'm there, we FaceTime each other so we can, quote, talk. Mm. He is quite lonely. And Anne says, I like having the ability to see him and assess how he looks and question him about any pain or other concerns. Yesterday, I was advised that the facility will no longer allow this type of visiting. Anne says, I'm heartbroken. Can you have your guests give their opinions on visiting through closed windows? And Anne, my heart goes out to you. I completely understand. I have two elderly parents myself in different facilities, and It's been tough not being able to see them. Boy, I'd love for everyone to jump in on this. And Todd, you first, please just talk about the social and emotional isolation that, you know, many elderly residents are facing right now, and the heartbreak of listeners like Anne.
Sure. Well, again, it is for those people in facilities, as we're talking about with Anne's father. It's for those people who are at home. You know, I have relatives for whom I'm a caregiver who are living by themselves in New Hampshire. Suddenly, within the past 30 days, they're told to essentially stay at home, and they're by themselves. And so I do think it's really critical to think about how we connect with people, because we still are social beings. But connection needs to make sure that we abide by all recommendations of the CDC and state health authorities and orders of our governor. But I would say people have a right to be connected in nursing home facilities. So certainly doing so in accordance with standards is critically important, CDC and otherwise. But people have a right to talk with them, and they have to be able to talk with them on some level. And I know many facilities in New Hampshire, potentially all of them, and I'm hoping all, are making it so that people can connect virtually, or they can have a telephone call, or they can do a Skype session or a Zoom session or something, because that's really critically important to people. But again, I still want to come back to the plight of the thousands and thousands of people who live in their community. And as Brendan rightly says, we have neglected this long-term care system. We don't want to fund that as robustly as we need to in New Hampshire. It does need some new money. And at this point, we are seeing some of the results of that with what all the callers are talking about and the guests are talking about. And I'm not casting blame. It's just that I think we've made some choices, and perhaps this might be an opportunity for us to revisit the choices we've made and decide how we take care of those people who are most vulnerable and how we care for those who care for them.
Well, I'll have a couple last questions for all three of you, and I really appreciate you again all joining us to talk about this. And Melissa, last question for you. As a former nursing home administrator, how do you view this time of stress for staff at these facilities? We've talked about residents, we've talked about staff. As someone who used to manage staff at a facility, how do you see it?
You know, this is a really hard time, obviously, for everyone in the state and everyone in the country and the world, but certainly those who are going to care for this vulnerable population they're a very caring group of people, and they do this work for a reason, and it's very difficult for them to go in every day and be worried if they're going to be, bringing something from the community into the nursing home and how they can protect the residents that they care for, how they can protect themselves. And then obviously they then have to leave the nursing home and go home to their families. And some of them aren't. Some of them are choosing to stay at the facility. Some of them are choosing to have hotel rooms. And so it is a really tumultuous time for these staff members. They're concerned about the people they care for. They're concerned about themselves and their families, and rightly so. It's a difficult time, but I think what's really important is that, you know, the long-term care community, they've really banded together. They're an amazing group of people who work very hard and diligently to ensure that the elderly and the vulnerable in our community are taken care of. And so there are some very dedicated people who are putting themselves in harm's way every day. And as Todd said, in the community and also in these long-term care facilities. And so they are a very special group of people, and it's a difficult time for them. So, it's hard, and it's hard as an administrator to get staff into the building because people are afraid. They have vulnerable people at their homes. Some of these people have vulnerable children who are ill or have other ailments that they have to be concerned about and bringing illness into their own homes. So it's just so difficult right now.
Well, Melissa, I really appreciate you being with us this hour, and I hope we talk again. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
That's Melissa St. Cyr, Chief Legal Officer at the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. Brendan, last question for you, please. What would you be looking for from the state to make the situation better for residents and for staff?
Well, I think, again, resources. You know, the federal government provided in a law that was passed March 18th, an additional 6.2% in federal Medicaid funding that has to be given out to long-term care providers, both in the home and community-based setting and also in the nursing home setting. Other New England states have done that, Maine, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. We need to do that too, because as Melissa said, the strain on staff right now is just absolutely tremendous. And I know it's not just true for facility-based staff, it's true for home care workers and others who are reaching out to me. They need the equivalent of hazard pay at this moment. And when even a state like Arkansas is giving an extra $250 a week to all direct care workers, whether they're in the home setting or in the facility-based setting, an extra $500 a week if they're dealing with COVID-19, I would hope that we as the state could be as enlightened as Arkansas.
Well, Brendan, thank you also very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Brendan Williams, President and CEO of the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. And Todd Fahey, I have to wrap it up now, but I know you have resources at AARP. We will put those on our website so that folks can access your advice for caring for their older loved ones in this difficult time. But I really appreciate you being with me this morning, Todd. Thank you.
Thanks, Laura. AARP.org, /coronavirus.
Okay. That's great. There's a lot of resources there. That's Todd Fahey, State Director of AARP New Hampshire, and this is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.